I live in Vancouver, a city that scores high in international lists of most enjoyable cities around the world. In this first episode of The Knots, I try to explore why that is. 125 years is the age now, young compared to cities in other parts of the world, where the history can be easily 1,000 years old. And in those 125 years, the idea, the identity of what Vancouver wants to be has changed several times. And these changes did not always happen voluntarily. It had to adapt.
I'm Gordon Price. I was born in Victoria in 49, so asked to run for office in 1986 by Gordon Campbell, and was in office for 6 terms from 86 to 2002. And then now, since 2005, been director of the SFU City Program. You know, you got to remember, fundamentally, this is one of the best places on the planet in so many ways, at location above all. Ice-free, deep water port, right next to a remarkably fertile delta, close to Asia, in a stable country that's not the United States, but still benefits from the advantage of living next to a neighbor that's going to keep you safe under its nuclear umbrella. Man, that, and it's new. It's new. Even its infrastructure hasn't really basically decayed and is pretty well maintained, so that we don't even have those kind of problems. We don't even have biting insects. I mean, this is a pretty good place to be, but fundamentally high density and mixed use and very high quality public spaces. Modernism, certainly after the Second World War, was the dominant architectural and design ideology. Made a lot of mistakes, learned a few things, and then...
What were the mistakes?
Well, modernism was based, I'd say, just fundamentally on the idea that you can do things that are big and simple and flat and square. You're just looking for an ideology. So whether it's a freeway or a high-rise public housing project, they're done on a massive scale, machines for living. Very Corbusian. The aesthetics of modernism, strip off the detail, use technology, form follows function, the building should be honest and express itself. So you had this emergence, whether it's in Toronto or the banlieue of Paris, of tower housing blocks, typically slab construction, poured concrete, reinforced concrete, high-speed electric elevators, a way of providing a lot of housing very quickly with an ideology that said we can create equality. Everyone can live in basically the same kind of development. This is Corbusier's idea of the outside Marseille, classic example. Mixed use, but the idea everyone would share more or less the same kind of urban form. People divide themselves out by class and ethnicity and just a whole bunch of things, and they want to express that kind of individuality. And so you get these small, relatively small, very simple, big and simple, flat and square, high-rises emerging by the dozens in the 1960s. Almost every building over 5 stories in the West End got built between 62 and 72. And that's probably the fastest change a neighborhood went through in Canada, with the exception of places like St. Jamestown in Toronto. But boy, it was fast, and it was brutal.
So Vancouver is lucky, but also not so lucky. When it started growing, it quickly ran into the ocean on the one side of the city and the mountains on the other side. And later in its development, it ran into the border with the United States of America. So quite early on, Vancouver had to find a solution to getting busier and busier. A principle that everyone I talked to for this documentary mentioned: densification. What can a city do when its population keeps increasing to avoid its streets from becoming one big mayhem?
There's always this option to spread out. That's what the automobile allows. And you get this car-dependent urban form. I call it motordom, M-O-T-O-R-D-O-M, a word that would have been used in the 1920s. At the time, the automobile was emerging as a popular form of transportation. Well, because of cheap oil and this... effusive technology that was, for the first time in human history, available to the average working person, land use followed. So you end up with the fundamental forms of what we call the suburbs. And again, it gets back to big and simple and flat and square. But the key is cheap land, cheap oil, cheap water, cheap money, and the best quality of life human beings have probably ever had. And so every other culture that looked to North America now says, well, you guys are at the top of the food chain. That's the way you did it. Guess we got to do it too. You know, why else would they be building freeways in Shanghai, for God's sake? It doesn't even make sense on the surface, much less. But it touches something profound. People like space. And when they get rich enough, they buy more of it. So, you know, you've got to, certainly from a governmental and planning level, acknowledge that. What Vancouver had no choice, because it was imposed by nature, well, it couldn't expand. It very quickly came up against its boundaries. So if downtown Vancouver in 1890, and we built out the downtown peninsula, about 2 square miles, having taken Stanley Park out of it, probably by about World War I. No, earlier. So where are you going to go? Well, you can still go out, obviously, and that's the first instinct. But I think Vancouver recognized right across the spectrum, rather like the Dutch did, we are going to have to make density livable for all classes of people. If the dikes come down, everybody drowns. If we're going to continue to be a growing city, we've got to find a way to do it. The rich always aspire to space, but they also recognize that there's got to be a range of livable communities as you rebuild the city. And by the 1970s, when that spirit was fully embraced, I think, we figured out a way to do it that at least met a pretty broad range of needs. But what made us exceptional? Well, we had to go up. So we found a way to take the high-rise form that had been rejected because it was associated with the poor and social failure and modernism, and found a way to make it aspirational for people right across the social spectrum. And you've only got a couple of choices. You crowd more people in the same amount of space, or you find a way to accommodate more people in more space.
One of the ideas of densifying downtown and building high-rises was to create more urban life in the streets. And so we get mixed development with buildings partially as office buildings and with their upper portions as residences, creating this urban life downtown so that the streets are not empty at night and presumably unsafe. Architect and real estate agent John Lightburn sees little evidence that this has really worked as the city had imagined.
You know, you can still drive downtown certain streets and there's nobody on those streets, whereas you can drive out to an area like Commercial Drive where there's absolutely no density. It's basically suburban, and yet you have a street which is one of the most liveliest streets in Vancouver. It's chock-a-block with restaurants, stores, Italian bistros, specialty food stores, and every manner of person walking up and down the street, riding their bike, skateboarding, rollerblading. It's quite an interesting street. And yet we get that life on the streets, and it's happened in spite of a lack of density. Whereas part of the program for all of the downtown has been, let's create density and have lively downtowns and lively streets and lots of restaurants and cafes. Well, you know, it's touted as a principle of urbanism, but in fact, you know, there is no real logical connection, not necessarily a logical connection between the two.
As most cities, what now is Vancouver Center was where the city originally started. Because of the challenges of being on a peninsula with a usable surface of less than 6 square kilometers, valuable lessons have been learned about densification. With populations growing globally, other countries want to learn from Vancouver. I talked to someone from the government of my own country of birth, the Netherlands.
Ik ben Eline Toes, ik ben 29 jaar en ik ben Rijkstrainee bij het ministerie van Vrom.
My name is Eline Toes. I am 29 years old and a trainee at the Dutch Ministry of Infrastructure and the Environment. Our chief architect studio sent me to the Dutch consulate to research sustainable urbanization.
In Nederland is er grote interesse om te kijken hoe er in plaats van, of misschien wel ook in plaats van het zomaar nodig...
Holland has great interest to, besides expanding our cities, see what we can further develop in the space that we already occupy.
En die blijken er gewoon in grote getalen te zijn, zeg maar. Dus je kan denken aan de transformatie van oude industriegebieden.
One could think of regions previously used as industrial areas or, for example, train yards.
Maar er schijnt dus in de binnensteden van Nederland van veel ruimte te zijn waar heel goed... Die heel goed ontwikkeld kunnen worden en
yeah, we see a lot of space in the Dutch cities that still can be developed. Because in Holland we do not have a lot of room.
Dus daar zit eigenlijk de parallel. En Rijksgebouwmeester die is nu een aantal keer hier naar Vancouver geweest.
Our chief government architect has been several times to Vancouver. That, despite having quite dense areas, still remains a pleasant place to live. It are the key decision moments, the defined course of action that possibly could be copied to the Netherlands.
Het handige daaraan is dat je zeg maar elektriciteit, riool, openbaar vervoer.
When we build in existing cities, the facilities like electricity, sewers, public transportation, schools, childcare, they are already present. Perhaps not enough, you do need to properly distribute or strengthen them. But still, building not outside but inside a city is also just cheaper.
Voordeliger dan bouwen buiten de stad.
Particular attention goes to the West End, a residential neighborhood covering 35% of the downtown peninsula. Gordon Price talks about its history.
And in the 50s, particularly 1956, when the zoning and development bylaw was passed for the first time, a zoning code that we think of in a contemporary way, and it had this mechanism called floor space ratio that was a very simple way to calculate density based upon the size of the site. So in the West End, which was just rezoned overnight, I'm quite sure the council didn't realize what they were doing, along with many of the other old streetcar neighborhoods. They allowed for this emergent form of the small point tower. They didn't change, and this is what saved our ass, I think, they didn't change the street grid. They didn't create super blocks, which is the form that the Europeans used, particularly in their banlieue or suburbs. They used a late 19th century urban grid, 66-foot rights of way, based upon the first surveys. You could acquire lots, 33, 66 feet, but you had a lane in the back. So you had basically a small site and a relatively low FSR, floor space ratio, plot ratio, somewhere between about 1, 2, 3, somewhere in there. That's pretty low density and by world standards. Well, after the boom, the high-rise boom, 1972, 71, the population would have been around, 38,000. Population didn't even double, even though the housing stock increased 5 times with all those high-rises. So what happened? Well, the West End uncrowded. People were living in these 2.5-story, what looked to be a single-family house on the surface, but from the attic to the basement, they'd all been cut up into suites. People would share the washroom down the hall, and were fortunate to have a kitchen at all if they did. So when all of this housing stock was demolished, almost overnight, people could move into, a one-bedroom apartment, 750 square feet roughly, sliding glass door, little balcony, maybe a swimming pool. Different kind of people, but nonetheless, it was a massive housing response to the exodus of young people, baby boomers, out of the suburbs and into downtown and the service jobs that were emerging. A massive increase in good quality, although from an architectural point of view, pathetic. I mean, slab high-rise towers. But affordable to young people who had jobs nearby, kept downtown alive, provided a retail base, but didn't fundamentally change the urban form. In this sense, that you still had that street grid, same sidewalks, same boulevards, same street trees, now trolleys running down where the streetcars would have gone, but basically the same urban form. 1- and 2-story retail, Robson, Denman, Davy. All that streetcar fabric was still intact, converted from streetcar to electric trolley, but no freeways. And that was the most important thing that didn't happen.
So a tranquil residential neighborhood, right downtown, right next to the business district. John Lightburn and I go for a drive through the West End, together with architect Niels van Meijenveld.
You got to admit, this is pretty lackadaisical driving. Here I'm in a fairly dense urban area, and I'm just sort of cruising around and not paying too much to street signs or anything.
People are
walking across the streets.
There's very little traffic here.
There's almost no traffic.
There's lots of people walking, though.
Yeah, lots of people walking. So here's a totally different character from, you know, any other urban neighborhood in Vancouver. Like, this is a neighborhood that it's... The relative density is fairly high. It's very close to downtown Vancouver. And, you know, you see people bike riding. And there's one street with traffic on it, which is Denman Street, which is the commercial street that subdivides the West End into two halves, basically. And we're in the most quiet half. And literally, there's almost nobody driving on the streets. Now, this is a really nice street. Look at all the window boxes that people have in their windows here.
If you look carefully, there's all sorts of little fun details to these old buildings.
Yeah.
Like that column stuck on the outside of the corner is wonderful. And another thing that I think has had a real influence on Vancouver is that the original settlers were Brits. And all over the world, actually, the Brits brought their love of gardening. Here's an old cottage that remains.
Yeah.
It's done sort of Tudor style, almost arts and crafts. There's some lovely arts and crafts houses here.
Martha Stewart.
And the stonework at the stairs is made out of river rock.
Local river rock.
Yeah.
And look at the incredible flower garden. That's and there's a big urn also sitting on a portion of the steps and. So this was something that the original people brought with them, a love for nature and a love of gardening. And I think that's found its way into the streetscape of an old streetscape like this in Vancouver.
I'm not so enthusiastic about it, frankly. It's what I would call oudbollig. Do you know that word, Niels?
Yes. Well, it is. And what he's saying is that it's old-fashioned. Yeah. And there's some truth to that. It's something that is so rooted in here that people don't even notice that it's getting a little bit fusty.
Yeah. Well, we in Vancouverites call this character houses. They tend not to think about what the architectural style is. It's simply character house or heritage.
These are preserved
style.
Houses. Yeah. Yeah.
I like it because I find that a lot of the modern architecture is so bland and, as Niels calls it, anonymous, that I do like these little old funny houses.
Little old lady neighborhoods, I call them. These are little old lady neighborhoods. But it was a lot of that around in the old days.
Yeah.
So we're sitting in a little traffic jam now, and this is the price we pay for not having built freeways, and we probably have traffic jams on them even if we had built them.
Because you know what happened when cities like Seattle built freeways? The growth of suburban neighborhoods leapfrogged outside of the city center. And the city cores in major U.S. cities all kind of deteriorated. Vancouver, as I say, blocked this idea of freeways into the city.
Stopped
the freeways. And so it's always had the best neighborhoods are always been those closest to the downtown Vancouver. And whereas the wealthy neighborhoods in cities like Seattle and Los Angeles are those that have gotten away from the downtown. And of course the leapfrogging of suburban development and then which created immense amounts of traffic and traffic jams, and then further leapfrogging beyond that. So the structure to the city of this, sort of like the urban structure of Vancouver, is different from American cities, and is actually even different from Toronto. We do have this vibrant core that has never been sliced into pieces. And the best neighborhoods are those closest to the downtown, period. They're the easiest to get to, and I don't think traffic's any worse than anywhere, because I've driven through Seattle many times at rush hour, and it's a nightmare.
A nightmare. Motordom, as Gordon Price calls it. the exodus out of downtown to the green fields, where land was cheap, where you could build post-war suburban housing, shopping centers, office parks, college campuses, everything separated, everything too far apart to walk, too dangerous to cycle, and transit too infrequent. You had to drive. And it was designed that way, and of course the people fully embraced that.
So what's happening is that the fact that we have relatively few routes in and out of the central business district, in and out of the downtown, the fact that there is limited capacity has, I think, affected the course of development in a way that does not really increase the amount of traffic coming into the central, because people find other means of doing it, or people find places to live where they're not so dependent on having to do the daily commute.
Quite normal for European cities, but rather unique in North America. Here we see the urban paradigm of making a city not car friendly, but walk, bicycle, and public transportation friendly. Jan Timmer is an urban planner and architect. He is also a Dutchman, though working internationally and locally in Vancouver for 35 years.
It's really a reversal of what the system used to be, where the engineering department in the city, in true North American fashion, really dictated what was going to happen and what the street profile would look like. That has totally changed. And one of the good examples is very nearby where we are, is Granville Island, which is one of the most popular tourist attractions in Vancouver, where there's a happy mix of pedestrians, bicycles, public transit, and the cars are tolerated. But it's a real mix, and it's not dangerous at all. So it can be done, and it is. And I'm speaking here from a North American perspective, because in Europe, these things, especially in the downtown areas of the major cities, are quite normal. And also in Europe, these things took a while for the local merchants to agree with. Once it was done, like in Copenhagen and in Germany and so on, it's been a great success. And so that's always being brought home here in North America as great examples. Even New York City right now, we just had a lecture from the woman who's took the paint can, and Times Square and so on, they're all very much bicycle oriented. There are outdoor terraces now. Used to be just cars, taxis, and so on. Right now, it's totally transformed. And Bloomberg and Mrs. Sadiq Khan did an incredible job convincing the local population that this was a good idea, and it works.
Granville Island, a successful bit of urban engineering, a famous section where nobody lives. Although called an island, it is in reality a piece of landfill right at the entrance of False Creek, underneath the Granville Bridge. Once an industrial manufacturing area, the federal government decided in the 1970s to transform it as an amenity area centered around a market. A number of old sheds were converted to workshops, to retail businesses, a restaurant, theaters, and a couple of hotels. But the architectural vocabulary was maintained. The wood post and beam structure, metal siding and metal roofing, giving the area a quite unpretentious personality.
So there's a young architect named Norman Hodson, who really hadn't done anything before in Vancouver, was given the assignment of coming up with a plan for Granville Island.
An urban plan.
And he did a brilliant job. He, apart from retaining just about anything that could be retained, he put forward the idea of having an environment where cars and pedestrians were really not in any way separated. It was intended that vehicles should move slowly enough so that people could walk safely at the sides of the roadways or across them. And I don't know whether this had ever been attempted before anywhere in North America. He introduced the idea of bollards to more or less demarcate where cars would be and where pedestrians would be and where parking zones might take place. The parking happens everywhere. It happens on open spaces, within sheds. It's actually a huge parking lot today, Granville Island. Granville Island has grown from modest beginnings to what is now, I would say, one of the most cleverly disguised shopping districts you'll ever find. In the beginning, farmers from outlying districts could come in and sell their goods, and also artisans and
What is an artisan?
An artisan is somebody who makes crafts, and also people that had different kinds of food, processed food products, jams, jellies, syrups, and that kind of thing, but in quite a highly finished environment. So this was immediately successful. And as time went by, the market went upscale. What was originally a fairly good imitation of a market became, in fact, a shopping arcade for high-end, shall we say, experiential shopping.
Yeah. And in smack dab in the middle of all of that, there is still an industrial plant here, which is a cement plant.
There's a cement plant here with many cement trucks parked right in the parking lot, and attempts have been made to move the cement plant and replace it with something perhaps more revenue friendly to the owners. But actually, this has been strongly resisted. We've got 25 large cement trucks parked here in front of the plant. And these cement trucks
roar in and out all day long.
Move in and out, and it doesn't cause any problem as far as I'm aware. In fact, I'm not sure. Have you ever heard of anybody getting hit by a car or a truck here on Granville Island?
Oh, just the people I've run over today.
Everywhere there are little nooks and crannies for people to sit. There's some music being played here in a little square.
Oh, yeah, the buskers come out in the summer and the fall and spring, and they're, you know, doing magic tricks and playing their instruments. Oh, here's a French guy. Those people are sitting around listening to this music, eating fish and chips and things of that nature. Hey, we got parking down here, guys.
Let's bring the microphones.
I'll stop.
No, it's a sensitive microphone.
Okay. So a group of French urbanists came to have a look at Vancouver not too long ago, and they made the comment that Vancouver is like a giant resort. And there's some truth in this. This city continues to grow. No one quite understands what's making it go. It hasn't stopped growing since the 50s. And I think one of the reasons maybe is because it is such a success in creating a lifestyle setting that offers many options and many ways to enjoy la dolce vita.
I'm just heading us towards the washroom.
Are you going to the washroom? Alright, when you talk in this direction, okay?
Test 1, 2.
Test.
Okay. We're now passing, we're inside the market, and we're passing a boutique where you can buy chocolates, 20 chocolates for $60.
Yes.
I'll meet you back here.
Out there? Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
So you call this a success, but you also say it's kind of a shopping mall in disguise. You mean that in a sneaky, negative way?
No, I was slightly cynical about the fact that what this market now offers is really beyond the financial reach of a lot of people. Mind you can still come here and have a slice of pizza and enjoy an ice cream.
Right, and that opposed to what a market is traditionally, it's a place where the simple people buy their goods.
Where ordinary people can get a right. good deal. You don't get any good deals here. But as a lifestyle enhancer, it's fabulous.
Yeah, precisely. I once heard a guy say that the first successful generation in the country.
I once heard a guy say that
the first generation makes money, then the second generation has got money, so they don't want more money, and they want power. Then the second generation has power and money, the third generation doesn't want that, so they go for art.
And the third generation wants art. And it seems that you can see that here. You can see that in what they sell at the local markets. I've lived on Pender Island, and there all you see is not even apples as what you see here, but it's only pieces of art and massages and esoteric...
growth phenomena.
Precisely, yeah. As opposed to what you would see in India on a market, it will be the essentials of life.
That's correct, yes. So we're standing now in a little waterfront square. The market wraps itself around. It's a lovely, lovely day. There are hundreds of people sitting here on benches, enjoying the warmth and the breeze. The water in the creek is reflecting the blue skies. It's slightly ruffled. And across the water, a very glamorous array of mostly light-colored high-rise buildings is glowing in the sunlight. They're beautiful. The little ferries are crossing the creek. There's a whole network of these that connect the downtown peninsula to where we are now. And for a modest fee, people can cross to come here to relax, enjoy themselves, and do some shopping. And lining the shore on the other side are, and this is another feature of Vancouver, an ever-growing armada of expensive yachts and vessels, sailing vessels of all descriptions. And we are, Granville Island is surrounded by small yacht basins, and they of course add a colorful element to the scene as they reflect into the waters, and no one ever seems to be on these boats.
That's true, yeah.
It is an indication of the wealth of this city that so many people have the privilege of owning boats. You can't imagine a more refreshing and uplifting scene than what we are experiencing here today. Life is good.
Yeah.
Let's have a break.
Let's have a bite to eat.
It stays on.
Okay, it stays on.
One cold Pepsi, please.
And I'll have a ginger ale.
Anything else?
Nothing to eat, no.
Oh, now let's see.
Ginger ale.
Bye, Mano. 320.
For me?
And yes, life is good, but not everywhere in Vancouver. In Vancouver's social history, the western side of the city was considered to be the wealthy, white, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant part. And the east side was traditionally a place for the working class, and it was the dumping ground for immigrants. Nowadays, the immigrants end up living in the suburbs because that is where the housing is least expensive. The poorest neighborhood, where I live, is known as the downtown east side, which is where Niels, John, and I drive next.
Look at this. I mean, there's people in wheelchairs, people laying on the street.
So people have set up a market here. There's people selling all kinds of different things. There's some garbage around, but I don't think there's anywhere these people can put their garbage, as you know. Yeah.
So these are all street people, and there's this is the busiest street in all of Vancouver, as far as number of people on the sidewalk.
And people are really interested when I'm talking into the microphone here as we slowly cruise by. People are looking in, and you don't find that happening in many other places. Nobody would take any notice of me. But actually, interestingly enough, here they do notice it.
Well, living in this neighborhood, a lot of people see this neighborhood also as a museum. They come here, take photos, and kind of not realizing that the people here actually live here. I often see people not being happy when people come here with film cameras.
Because they might think they're freaks or something.
Right. Well, look. What we're looking at here is this complex here was... Go ahead! No, you stupid woman. Just go around me. Okay. Anyways, right. Well, look across this vacant lot here, and we see the backs of a new condominium building right stuck in between two rundown, rather derelict older buildings. And then we go another block that way, and we're into the heart of Gastown, which is again a tourist area. So it's got we've got this sandwiches, but the center of the sandwiches is pretty seamy.
And now, you know, if you're a sort of a nice middle class person, the first reaction you might have.
Look at the graphics on that wall.
Is, oh, isn't this awful? But I think that would be a very slanted view.
It's my building.
Of what's going on here. I think there's what's going on here is a tremendous effort at both rehabilitation and at...
I don't know. I don't think there's much in the way of rehabilitation here, Niels. I think what it is
well,
just
I think
the
there
city
is a lot of people working.
You were talking about the city growing eastward.
Mm-hmm.
Well, here it's, you know, there's the new urban edge right there.
Now pushed eastward.
It's pushed its way in to the poorest part of the downtown east side.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to continue to do so. And I guess basically it's going to crowd those people.
Well, it's actually
somewhere. Who knows?
I'm perhaps not the best person to talk about this because I don't live here and I don't mix with the people here, so I don't have a very clear viewpoint of what's going on. But what I'm trying to say is that this is their place where they can, you know, be.
Where they can gawk back at the tourists.
Yeah. And I guess their view of normal society, if I were in their position, I'd look at normal society as a pretty strange bunch of people.
Oh, yes.
You know, and I'm finding that the fact that it sits so smack in the middle of, you know, huge development trends in Vancouver, and that there are people buying condos in new developments here, right in the middle of all the dysfunction, is very interesting. And I think
it's quite
that the situation here is as bleak as it could be, because people are, there's a certain level of acceptance of what's happening here. Otherwise people wouldn't move in here and there wouldn't be these developments cropping up right in the middle of all the street misery. So I think there's connecting happening here, and I think a huge amount of international and national attention is focused on the downtown east side, and it's a problem that nobody seems to have any answers for. But I do see a lot of channels that are there for communication and for some way forward for people. I think if you want to try and get yourself out of this situation, I think there's a lot there that can help you. You may not be able to, but
it's kind of interesting. Like here, we're back into this new urban development.
It's just a half block away.
Yeah.
There's
it's just squeezing its way.
Well, maybe that's the part that I'm trying to be positive about.
This is the new urban renewal. It's not institutional or government funded. It's private development is funding it. And a lot of it is international money that sort of comes into Vancouver and says, hey, we can profit here, or we can park some money here. It's a safe place.
You know, you can't say that it's your fault that you wound up this way, because a lot of people have so many strikes against them from very early age onward.
A lot of people, but I know.
You see,
I used to come down here to hire a guy to work for me, and he lived down on the east side. It was cheap. He was getting his welfare. He was getting paid under the table by me, and he was being able to spend all his money on drugs and gambling.
An addict. You have to know the nature of addiction. Addiction is something that's really, really difficult to fight because you're wired to it. You know, it's like, it's if
you have a memory for addiction.
Guys, I'm going to cut all this out. None of us here is an expert on addiction.
We're just bullshitting at this point.
We're going to round.
Well, we look at some of these downtown East Side residents and with disdain, but, you know, I've known some, and some of them actually like their lifestyle.
Of course they do.
Most of them do.
Sure. I mean, that's also been determined that not people, whatever state of life they're in, they don't want to change.
Can't go right.
Whoops. Here we are in Gastown going the wrong way.
Niels, do you know Richard Florida?
Yes, I do.
Okay. I heard him talk about how the young generation of inventors and especially nowadays the creative engineers move to these areas where there's a lot of diversification and, strangely enough, also the cities where that are welcoming gay communities.
Yes.
The cities with that are welcoming creative artists and alternative lifestyles become breeding grounds for new economies.
That the artists are the first in there.
Yeah.
And then that, because they often select the nicest spots and the create, and are creative essentially, and that then those communities attract or are supplanted by other creative groups. I think you could say that about commercial, when the
Commercial Drive,
because as the initial, I don't think the initial transformation was by artists. It came later. It came when the Italian community matured and began to move out into the suburbs and became less of a factor in the cultural life of Commercial Drive. What came then, this was in the 70s and 80s, a new alternative people who were into alternative lifestyles, a lot of not only creatively but also with respect to sexual orientation, a lot of gay people, lesbian people settled in the Commercial Drive area, and also a lot of creative people with not a lot of money but who needed to be in the city and saw it as a place where you could buy cheaply and fix up and improve.
Yeah, well, my daughter Shelley likes to say that when you're in gentrification, actually she did her thesis on the gentrification of Harlem, actually she had a little expression. She said that first comes the gays, then comes the gals, because the gays go there because they find a place where they could live, where they're not going to be, you know, bruised, ostracized, whatever. The girls go there because they can relate to the gays and they feel somewhat safe with these gentlemen. And then the yuppies show up because, you know, here's an interesting neighborhood where they can live, where prices have not gotten too high. And so
it's
there's
got character.
Kind of a, it's kind of a process that goes there that Niels is referring to has happened in Commercial Drive. You know, and artists, of course.
Mm-hmm. And the gays also make more interesting homes. They're better at decorating and
precisely.
Yeah, and they're willing to fix up something.
And the artists do nice things with the dwellings they're in, and then.
And the artists, of course, don't have as much money, so they go to urban areas where properties are cheaper.
Plus, not as mind-numbing as concrete.
Concrete towers.
My journey through Vancouver with Niels and John continues. We drive to Vancouver's latest development, Olympic Village.
So here we are at the Olympic Village, which is just built for the Olympics athletes. And the scale and nature of the development, even though it's in terms of its time frame, is not
Wow, we're just going in.
It's not different, you know, it's immediately following on the development on the north side of the Falls Creek, which is still going on. And here we are into a development on the south side, which west of us was done in a completely pastoral fashion. And here we have this density, which is almost draconian in some respects. It's actually a totally different urban model from what we've been just been looking at and discussing. And what we have here is a very rigid urban planning, considerable density, and instead of wide boulevards, there's these very narrow streets with...
They remind me of alleys, actually.
Yeah, they're very much like alleys, but with very high buildings.
How high are these buildings?
Well, they're about 8 stories. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Yeah, about 8 stories. And, of course, there's these squares.
There's one square in the middle of it.
Yeah, which is definitely a square. but with a wall of buildings around it. And it's not a big square.
No, it's...
It's like a... quarter of a city block, maybe.
200 feet by 400 feet, something like that.
Well, not even 400 feet. I think it might
be. There's some funny things here, John. There's some artwork. There's a giant...
worms.
Are they worms?
There's a big giant bird there.
Well, there's a little bird. Well, normally it would be a junco or some kind of little sparrow that's been rendered to about 100 times its natural size.
Well, 1,000 times, 10,000 times. I mean, it's 15 feet high. There's another one there in the trees.
Oh, yeah, there's two of them. So there are these massive blow-ups of tiny songbirds. Looking at their feet here, the claws emanating from the feet are about 5 inches long. So this is quite a strange kind of statement. I'm not quite sure what it tries to say.
The big birds, could it have been an attempt to... create an optical illusion to make everything look smaller and more intimate.
You could sure look at it that way.
Yeah, I mean, if you took a look at, if you took a photograph of that bird against the buildings, you might think that those buildings are really just models.
Something I'm noticing is that it's really actually quite quiet in here. There's a couple of boys that are skateboarding, and the sound of their skateboards is about the only noise I can hear. The other thing I'm noticing is that the sort of traditional separation of street and sidewalk has been done away with here. It's just one, except for on the corners where the streets meet, that it tends to be one continuous surface of pavers. So there's a lot of unusual elements to this project. Yeah. There's a girl sitting now doing some sketching. Quite a variety of seating is available, and the square is open to the creek, I'm happy to say.
Gordon Price looks at the Olympic Village project from a historic context.
Olympic Village is just basically another variation and a direct continuation of the ideas that emerged in this remarkable period in the 70s. I mean, think of the risk that was involved down here. You got to remember the Falls Creek was just a polluted industrial basin. It was awful. Yeah, and people have no idea how bad it was. They built the seawall on the south shore of Falls Creek so you couldn't touch the water. You go along there and you'll see how it's slanted. So bad was the water quality. The air, unbelievable. From Broadway, you wouldn't even be able to see sometimes the downtown office towers, much less the North Shore Mountains. There were beehive burners just burning, you know, wood right into the environment, just dumping nasty stuff into the water. Well, that's all changed, and it changed very, very fast. But back then, the idea that you would build a residential development, a place where families could raise children on the shores of Falls Creek, some people thought that was just nuts. Some wanted it to keep it purely industrial, like Harry Rankin, basis for jobs. Some, like George Peel, head of the park board at that time, wanted it nothing but park. Very few people thought the risk of trying to provide a residential neighborhood down there would pan out well. And yet it turned out to be one of the genius things we did. Let's give credit to Walter Hardwick back then. geographer at UBC who got elected as one of the first team counselors. When they were in the majority, they really pushed ahead with it. Well, they were acquiring land. The city was acquiring land. That's the only reason they could go ahead with the development. They owned it. And the same with the southeast shore of False Creek. But when I was in council there, we wanted to raise the bar on sustainability. So that was put into the kind of the direction that the Southeast project would have to pursue. The Olympics wasn't even on the table at that point. And so it has reflected itself, first of all, in the spirit that the city will direct development and use its land base as a way to do it. It will try to achieve social and environmental goals, and it will try and push the bar. It will try and do something only the city can do. Otherwise, you might as well just sell the land off and put in terms of the contract the whatever it is that you want the developer to meet. Just more or less, in this case, the way it happened, but only because the city could lever that. Now, mistakes were made, obviously, but if someone could have predicted a global financial crisis and a developer who unwisely overbid and construction costs that, you know, were very high at that point in time, yeah, you'd probably make different decisions. But the city followed through on the spirit, I think, of the 70s and established that it was appropriate for a civic authority to try and do something that would reflect our values and raise the bar and provide more housing stock in a city for whom that's always going to be a fundamental issue. Now, does it meet everybody's expectations? Did it work out well financially? Obviously not. So we should never do anything like that again? Is that really the conclusion you want to draw from it? The city should get out of that business, sell off its land holdings, let the market determine what's viable, put in terms of bylaws those things you want to meet environmental criteria rather than actually lead the way? I would have a different opinion.
Back in the car with Niels and John, Niels notes something about the aesthetic appearance of the plants and trees.
The other thing I've noticed that the landscaping here, because the streets are so narrow, consists of very narrow varieties of trees. And I'm actually noticing that some of them are planted close to the buildings and are bumping their heads up against overhanging balconies, which is a really strange sight to see a new tree, maybe 15 feet high, bumping into a projecting overhang. And it's been generously planted so that in time this will give a completely different sheltered aspect to the square.
Well, it's hard to say because these look like kind of dwarf species of trees. These are not like the London plane trees that grow into giant specimens that, you know, that shelter even, you know, five-story buildings. But I've noticed that we've got this reminiscence of the Canadian myth, because in the landscaping, is reflected in the landscaping, because here we see there, we've got wheat grass, which has been planted in these square boxes, and the wheat is in bloom. It looks like you could go out there and harvest and grind the wheat and make bread.
There are planters that actually do have only grasses growing in them. And they're somewhat reminiscent of what you might find along a pond or a bog. So there's different varieties. So,
well, it immediately gives me images of the prairies where the wheat used to grow, you know, as Canadians.
That's right. It's like a little reminder of somewhere else altogether. Yeah.
So I decided to talk to one of the landscape architects working on the Olympic Village. Here is Peter Kreuk, who talks about his involvement in the design for this neighborhood. They had to design an atmosphere where people feel comfortable getting to know their neighbors.
As designers, we created a stage where these interactions can happen. There's plazas, there's courtyards, there's waterfront, there's community center. These are the places where people are going to gather, get to know each other, and build a community. So hopefully in 5-10 years' time, you can walk down the street and say hello to Bob and Jane, and, you know, they're the grandkids over for the weekend again. And that's what we want to happen in our spaces, and we have to create the places for it. The attempt at the Olympic Village is one of to create community. The objective there was to have a commercial core, which included, you know, your needs for grocery and banking and coffee shops and restaurants as a core, supported by a fair density of residential. which in Vancouver, the objective here is to have a wide range of housing types so that the wealthy, as well as the poor, cannot live in a neighborhood, not all of one type. So you don't create rich ghettos and you don't create ghettos for the poor, but you have a blend of people. There's a community center that's supposed to function as the heart. So what we're doing is creating something from nothing, because there was nothing there to start with. And communities are can be created overnight. But as planners, landscape architects, we try to put the bits and pieces in place which allow the community to evolve over time. So there's facilities there. Without the people, you don't have community. Without the density, you don't have community.
Niels and John, with whom I'm still at the Olympic Village in a car, take note of the character of the buildings.
From the outside, it looks singularly, shall we say, machine tooled. The architecture is
high tech. It's
the new modernism again, which we've had around for about 20 years now since postmodernism. We see a lot of glass. We see a lot of metal. We're actually beside a drugstore. Well, it hasn't opened yet. But I wouldn't have guessed that it was going to be a drugstore because the fenestration is sort of, again, a kind of anonymous. It's as if they're made to look, they're tucked away with enormous, shall we say, I guess I'm going to give it a little bit of a loss for word now, but there's an attempt not to make commercial activities look like commercial activities. They're concealed, they're downplayed, they're made to seem less there. And I wonder if that's an attempt to maintain the privacy of these types of new developments. They don't want people from the outside coming in and animating these places. They're intended for the local residents only. Nobody wants to have a party here, it looks like. It looks like this is kind of very low-key living, where there's, mind you, not many people are here yet, because this is another little bit of history that perhaps we should mention, John, which is how this project ran into financial difficulty.
Yeah. All right, furthermore...
Look, there's an electric vehicle charging station here.
Oh, heavens, yes.
Hold on. You know, the other thing that should be noted about...
Oh, no kidding.
this project is that it is extensively green, and it has it conforms to some of the highest rankings for sustainability and eco-friendliness.
You would never get that impression, though, from looking, because everything is hard surface, hard edge. The plaza is at least 95% paving stones, and the landscaping is, you know, like I say, a few grasses within some planted, square planted areas, planters, and the trees are miniature. So it's kind of funny that this is representative of green architecture and
in the sense,
green
John,
urbanization.
We're not growing anything here, are we?
Yeah.
Or are we? Are we inside some of these... we have sort of mini blocks. The buildings that line the streets here create interior courtyards, and I know that the roofs of those, which themselves are somewhat raised up above the ground, these courtyards, and the roofs of these are private green space for people.
And yeah, indeed, we have a lot of green roofs in the latest developments in Vancouver. I talked about this with Peter Kreuk.
Our marching orders are through planning are to create a village that is, in plan view, there's 50% green. So to look down on the site, 50% of the area you see has to be green
from above.
So if you look at the plan, where nobody looks, but that the idea there is that it has to be green, which means it has to be living. There has to be plant material there. And I have a 30-year time frame to look at this as a landscape architect. When I first came here, the amount of landscape on a project was fairly limited. Shrubbing up the edges is what we called it. We had some commercial buildings which would have plazas and such, but to develop roof podiums, to develop green roofs on various levels, to we have the sense of kids play urban agriculture. Urban agriculture wasn't talked about 3 years ago, and now pretty well every project we do has some component of gardening, for so people who live in the building can go there and participate in gardening. The outdoor patio spaces on roofs have become much, much larger than they were before. Developers never saw the opportunities in these outdoor patio spaces, which are now they realize that people will pay a lot more for a unit that has a nice big outdoor patio space that that overviews the city. It's exciting. It opens up so much to us.
Vancouver is now trying to bill itself as one of the world's foremost green cities.
Yeah. And to me, this doesn't feel green at all. I mean, you know,
the idea was to reduce the load on the larger systems by using high-tech approaches to minimizing consumption of energy and resources. So that's a kind of invisible aspect of this project.
Definitely invisible, because it doesn't have a green feel to it in my...
Except for this electric vehicle charging station that is stuck like a sort of large transformer box into the square that we're sitting next to. So I guess if you want to charge your car, you've got to bring it here, and rather than doing that from your residence.
Yeah, that's kind of interesting, the graphics on that station there, because it kind of looks like a flame from a natural gas source to me.
Doesn't it, though? Yeah. Yeah.
I'm noticing several things, too. The reeds that are part there of the grass. Now, coming from Holland, I immediately recognize them from the type of grass that grows in canals, where the water is not running very fast. Yeah. So it gives me a Dutch impression.
Yeah, Tristan has felt that this is a kind of, when we drove through the other day, this is really reminiscent of the new towns in Rotterdam, I think you said.
Well, it started in Rotterdam because that was that had to start building new stuff after the war, but also in more modern neighborhoods elsewhere in the Netherlands. Yeah, I certainly get that impression by the intimacy that we have here, and also the this may all be new, this square, but it looks like it almost was planned to not be completely straight. Of course, you want the running water, the rain water, to flow towards
the drains
up there. But I think they kind of overdid it, maybe on purpose, to make it look not so new, mm-hmm. maybe not so sterile. Also, the gutter in the street is in the middle of the road. Yeah. I've never seen that anywhere in North America yet.
Mm-hmm.
The people that we have seen walk here on this piece of the road have all walked in the center of the road and not on the sidewalk.
Yeah.
Right, that's interesting.
Noteworthy details that journalists from all over the world would see when the Olympic athletes arrived in the winter of 2010. It makes sense that the city wanted to create a neighborhood that was not something just okay, but something very special. In the last hour, we have looked at several of Vancouver's neighborhoods, some obvious choices when profiling Vancouver. The West End, Granville Island, downtown Eastside, and the Olympic Village. The total picture is, of course, much more complex. Greater Vancouver, a mosaic of urban curiosities. Here, a last remark by Gordon Price, emphasizing that it could be easy to overlook interesting development happening in the suburbs surrounding Vancouver.
Because Vancouver, it's by and large done. I mean, we built it out. It will change. But the real issues, I think, are the emerging change in the post-war suburbs. Places like Surrey that are going to go through their own form of urbanization, their own ways of dealing with, quote, sustainability issues. This remarkable change that's going to occur between the post-war era and whatever era we're going into. And I think that's where the suburbs are more than Vancouver. I think they're much more willing to make changes in Richmond, parts of the North Shore, certainly Surrey. Maybe the Northeast sector once Evergreen Line arrives. Certainly Port Moody did. Port Moody took a lot of the Vancouver style, and really took a risk in concentrating it in its downtown core. Remarkable scale. Far more of interest to many of the people who I show around often than downtown Vancouver. It's going out into the suburbs and seeing how that change is occurring, how they've learned urban skills and techniques from what we did down here and then begin to apply it, quote, out there. All part of the same region. But if we're going to get 80% of our growth inside that boundary, they're the guys who really make the difference. And then they will take the pressure off Vancouver. The idea that someone should show up here and they can expect to live in Vancouver, it's going to be tough to pull off.
This was episode 0 of The Knots. A total of 10 hours was recorded and all are available on the website. In addition to the neighborhoods that ended up in this episode, together with Niels and John, I visit the north side of Falls Creek.
There's something distinctive about this bit of the downtown.
Stanley Park.
We're standing on the seawall. The tide has gone out. We've got this rocky foreshore in front of us.
Strathcona.
More than worthwhile to fix and repair and turn into their little urban cottage.
And Chinatown.
At one time, just about every corner grocery store in all over Vancouver would be owned by Chinese people.
But also interviews with both of them individually. John Lightburn talks about his time as an architect working in Saudi Arabia.
They kept rejecting it because they kept seeing hidden Christian symbols in the planning of the university.
I interviewed architect Niels van Meijenveld in Dutch, and we discussed things like his youth in the city of Amsterdam.
Now, Amsterdam is also afgemaakt, hè? Als een klein kind heb ik mijn fiets gereden in Bosplan. En dat vond ik heerlijk.
Here is an excerpt of my recording with Jan Timmer, who describes how he first got interested in architecture.
I'm very much inspired by being alive as a human being and being part of nature. So I'd like to express that in my profession.
We hear Peter Kreuk describing parallels between his personality and his work as a landscape architect.
Everything in our house had a place. So everything, you know, I can still go home to my house now and I can tell you where the towels are, like where everything's put away. And it's still very much how we approach the landscape. Everything has a place. Everything has a function.
And in particular, I recommend checking out my 45 minutes together with urban planner and former politician Gordon Price.
The net result, when you add up all the buildings done by all the individual architects, reads as a cohesive place that functions well for the people who have to live in it and can adapt to change over time. I'm not sure how well we've done on that.
And lastly, also in Dutch, my talk with Eline Toes from the government of the Netherlands.
Ik vind Vancouver een hele prettige woonstad. Het is wat braaf, zeg maar.
All recordings are available along with the show notes and a full transcript at thenots.com/0. And remember, it is The Knots, not Knots. THENOTS.com.